Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by one of our contributing editors, Neil Smith.
Hello.
Hello, Neil. So this week we are going to be talking Horrible Bosses with Nicholas Hoult, and we'll be rating comedy horror actioner Renfield, anime Suzume, and corruption drama Cairo Conspiracy. But before we get on to those, Neil, what else have you been watching this week?
Well, it's been an Easter weekend of catching up on TV. I've been watching the second season of Schmigadoon, which is now subtitled Schmicago because they've moved on to the 70s era of slightly darker and more sexy musicals like Chicago and Cabaret. So I'm enjoying that. I don't think it's quite as funny as the first season, but maybe that's the point. Maybe it is a sort of more the darker follow-up, but I'm enjoying that. And I'm watching on Sky Dreamland, which is a Margate set drama in which Lily Allen makes a pretty good acting debut as one of four sisters dealing with romantic shenanigans on the southeast coast.
Yeah, I saw Lily in 222, A Ghost Story, and she was excellent in that. So I'm not surprised she's doing well in this. I must watch that. It is on my list. I've been watching The Warriors because I went to New York and reenacted their entire journey. And so I decided to give myself the treat of watching the director's cut of The Warriors when I returned and took great pleasure in seeing the Wonder Wheel and knowing that I'd slid around on that. It's one of those huge sort of carousel wheels, but that has sliding cars on it. I've never been on one of those before. It's very exciting. You're nodding, Neil, like you understand this. You've been on these before.
I know it. I haven't been on it, but I do know the wheel of which you speak.
Yeah, it's very exciting. So that's what I've been doing. But shall we crack on? Because we've got a wide range of films to talk about this week. Let's start with this and get bloody with this.
Renfield, bring in innocent victims. I want a handful of nuns, a busload of cheerleaders.
And I just want a normal life again.
But this modern world is a dangerous place.
So this is Renfield, the story of Dracula's put-upon servant who is sick of his boss in modern-day New Orleans. Renfield himself, Nicholas Hoult, sat down with Emily Garbutt to talk about Nicolas Cage and vampires and everything else in between. Here's what he had to say.
Some call me the Dark One, others the Lord of Death. To most, I am Dracula.
Okay, obviously we're dealing with a little bit more than just narcissism here.
Hello to Nicholas Hoult and welcome to Inside Total Film.
Hey.
Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
So to start us off, can you tell us who Renfield is?
Yes, Renfield is Dracula's familiar, his servant, who has been working for him for 100 years, almost essentially since the classic 1931 Dracula film, and is tired. He is exhausted. He has been run down by Dracula, and he wants to escape.
So your co-star Nicolas Cage has spoken about taking inspiration from Christopher Lee and other actors who played Dracula for his performance, but Renfield has much less of an on-screen legacy. So did that make your job harder or easier?
I think it depends. I think obviously with Dracula, people then have such an idea of who he is on screen and their interpretation of their favourites, perhaps. Whereas with Renfield, he hasn't appeared in every Dracula movie, and he was more of a secondary character when he has. So I probably did feel a sense of freedom through that. But there was also this really nice rooting in you know, the novel and being able to go back and read that and kind of that Renfield, but then go through and watch Dwight Frye or Tom Waits or Peter McNichol and kind of go, okay, what do I like about their performances? What can I steal? For instance, Dwight Frye's laugh, I was like, oh, this is such an iconic, brilliant laugh. I feel like that would be great to kind of pepper in or have a little taste of occasionally. But as I say, this story is taking place 100 years later and the crazed kind of fervor of Renfield working for Dracula in those movies and what he is there has kind of waned a lot and it's settled into kind of this morally ambiguous at times conflicted character who who kind of is doing his best but just doesn't believe in himself or where he's ended up and lives with a lot of regret.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, speaking of Nicolas Cage, I'm sure you've been asked this a lot, but you know, what was it like working with him?
It was fantastic. I was lucky I got to work with him when I was 14 and had a great time working with him then. Found him to be so professional and dedicated and to set a really nice tone on set. But then to work with him again here, and I mean, going back to what you said about the inspiration of like him going back and kind of creating silhouettes similar to Bela Lugosi, but then the look of Christopher Lee at times, but then also using bits of Anne Bancroft from the Graduate and kind of using a little bit of his father's voice, because he imagined that that kind of erudite, eloquent intelligence that his father possessed was something that he wanted to bring to this character. So there's just so many interesting things that he was bringing to the character, and also making Dracula someone who is the lord of evil and darkness and all these things, but also someone who can be hurt by Renfield and emotionally has been abandoned by all the people he's loved through eternity, essentially. So there was just a lot of depth and humour and fun that he was having with that role.
Yeah, and I'm sure when you've got that on set, that kind of rubs off on you. And
yeah, completely. It's just fun to be in scenes then, because you watch what Nick's doing, you're like, oh, this is great, because he's bringing this up and he's committing there, and that's making the scene like just elevate the stakes to this different level and then bringing it back down. So it's just really fun to be in scenes with him, because it's also, for Renfield, it's something that he never knows with Dracula if he's going to lash out and hurt him or if he's going to kill him with kindness and love. And so that was something that was also fun as an actor. I was like never quite sure where Nick would go with certain scenes or moments, and made it very easy for me to be on the back foot and kind of cautionary around him.
As we've said, Renfield's not been in a lot of TV and movies and things, but vampires obviously have. So what is it about this film that makes it different from sort of the rest of the vampire genre and what's come before?
It's a real mix. This feels very original in terms of the tone of it. You know, it's being described as a comedy, horror, action film, I suppose, which it instantly to mesh those three together, but also to take the classic characters and flip them on their head and subvert expectations, kind of what Chris McKay, the director, is so talented at doing, what he did with Lego Batman, and to have fun with them. So to kind of keep the audience guessing, I guess, is what really appealed to me about this film. And not necessarily about it being a vampire story, but about it being just an original idea and concept and something that was unexpected. Yeah, you know, both overall, but also scene to scene, like, where is this going? What is happening? And hopefully that's the experience that people will have watching it.
Yeah, and I guess another element that makes it a little bit different is Renfield's relationship with Awkwafina's character, Rebecca. That's obviously a key part of the film. So can you talk a bit about that and what that means for your character?
Yeah, so Awkwafina plays Rebecca, who is a New Orleans city police officer who is fighting crime in a city that is very corrupt and struggling to find any justice, essentially, for what happened to her father, this crime family who is kind of running amok in the city. And the big turning point for Renfield is seeing Rebecca stand up to this crime family and stand up for herself. Mm-hmm. And that kind of just switches something inside of him where he goes, well, hang on, this is, you know, the monster I've been dealing with, I can't stand up to, I don't know how, but I've just seen Rebecca do that. So maybe that inspires some sort of change in him, which then isn't easy, you know, it's 100 years of habit and fear and all those things built up. So it takes him time to still figure out how he's going to escape Dracula rather than just take the easy route and believe in himself.
The way that she sees him as well allows him to see a different side to himself, or a side that he maybe didn't know was there.
Yeah. I mean, she describes him as a hero, which you know, he's always seen himself as somewhat of the villain or the villain's apprentice. Mm-hmm. You know, he has been supplying Dracula with victims for a long time and probably murdered quite a lot of people. So there's obviously clearly something on his conscience that doesn't sit well with that, even if he's trying to find loopholes and trying to find potentially bad people that he can be like, okay, I'm helping others by getting rid of this person. But it's still something that he's, yeah, never viewed himself as someone who could potentially do and be good.
Your director, Chris McKay, actually referred to the film as a superhero movie. So I guess it's maybe not how he sees himself, but how other people see him. As you said, it's a mash of different genres, but yeah, it's that different take on a hero, I suppose.
I suppose so. He doesn't view himself as a hero, but he has good qualities and bad, which is what's fun to play as well.
Yeah. Anti-hero, I guess.
Yeah.
So, yeah, in order to, you know, power up and face off against the bad guys, Renfield eats bugs. Am I right in thinking that those were real insects that you were eating?
They were sometimes. The crickets were real. And honestly, pretty tasty, to be fair. They were salt and vinegar flavoured and barbecue flavoured, and okay. They were dried out, so they weren't too bad. The potato bug I ate wasn't good. That was pretty grimy.
Is that like a potato-y texture? Is that why it's
got
that
name? No, still crispy and dried, but okay. Just tasted terrible. It tasted very dirty. The cockroaches were actually caramel, so they were pretty yummy. And the worms were like gummy worms in crushed up Oreos, so they were also yummy. So there were some good days and bad days.
So why did they make you eat the potato bug when you had so many other options?
I think we were just trying stuff out. We were like, well, let's see. The ones that I drew the line at, they had, when we first went to the props department, we're looking around all the props and stuff, they were like, oh, well, these are some of the bugs we can try. But they also, like, you can order all this stuff quite easily dried out. And there were, like, some bigger spiders and scorpions and stuff. And I was like, I don't know about this. The smaller bugs, I feel like, okay, I can kind of manage this. When they get bigger, it's like, ugh.
Yeah, fair. And actually, speaking of creatures, there's, you know, sort of bats flying around and some quite big swarms of them. So were they real or were they?
No, all fake bats.
No, I wasn't sure because I did read that, you know, Chris McKay's aim was to sort of, you know, have as little CGI as possible. So I was wondering, but I guess you can't really train bats.
I don't think so. But I mean, maybe there's someone out there who can train bats. But we didn't find them in time to use them in this, sadly.
Fair enough. Yeah. And you're set to appear in another vampire movie, Nosferatu,
yes.
From Robert Eggers of The Lighthouse and The Northman fame, which I can imagine is going to be very, very different.
yes.
So can you tell us anything about that?
Rob has wanted to make Nosferatu, I think, since he was 8 years old, and did a play of it as well when he was in high school, I think. And so it's been a passion project of his for a long time. And honestly, I mean, I wasn't looking to go back into the vampire world again, but as you say, like, his style and tone are just so completely the opposite of this film, and I'm such a fan of his work that I'm excited just to be in his world and watching him and learning from him, and I think the film could be really special, so I'm excited for people to see it.
So that's Nicholas Holt discussing Renfield. Did it work for you?
It's fun. There's a lot of fun to be had. It knows that it's a little bit silly. It knows that it's got a lot of sort of history to play with, and it does a pretty good job. Nicholas Holt plays Renfield as a sort of rather nervy, nerdy man with very low self-esteem. And in fact, the running gag is that he's unburdening himself to a help group for people who have toxic relationships in the workplace. And like I think Dracula himself doesn't have a great deal to do. But of course, every time he comes on, it's Nicolas Cage.
And, it's Nicolas Cage doing his British accent, which is a bit wobbly, but that's okay because, you know, he is just chewing up the scenery as well as victims in this film. I think he's a hoot in this, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, it proves a little Nicolas Cage goes an awfully long way. And every time he comes on, he just kind of gives the movie this jolt of eccentric energy and electricity. His line readings are just so...
So Nicolas Cage. They're so Nicolas Cage.
And then you think, and I'm wondering, why hasn't Nicolas Cage been cast as Dracula before? I mean, this is the perfect casting. And he really makes the most of it. And maybe because he's in it, like, he's not the central character. When every time he turns up, he kind of just lifts things up a notch and makes things even more kind of fun. There's an awful lot of rather bloody violence. Mm. I learned a new phrase from the Total Film interview with Nicholas Holt, splatstick, which is it is very splattery and also very slapstick. So that's obviously where that phrase comes from. And actually, there's a kind of quite nice sort of romantic element between him and Awkwafina, which is fun. It's all very short, though. I think it could have been longer.
Yeah, yeah. And we never say that. We're often complaining about films being too long, but this is under 90 minutes. And actually, when it finishes, you're like, oh, I was really into that. And it just sort of stops. Yeah. But then isn't that quite nice? You go to see a big blockbuster with a load of special effects, loads of action, as you say, lots of blood, lots of limbs being ripped off and dismemberment. And you're out in time for a drink at the pub.
Yeah, I think it's good that they managed to tell the story in such an economical sort of period of time. There's more they could have put in. In fact, there's an entire dance sequence that they shot and cut. There's images of it over the credits. You think, oh, I wonder where that would have fitted in. So, yeah, I mean, it is a rare movie. I think I could have had a 15 minutes more of that. I wouldn't have complained.
But maybe you may get more of it if it's a hit. I mean, it has scope to go for a sequel, I would think, with that little romance, as you mentioned. We don't really get fully into that. It's sort of hinted at and it's coy and it's sort of flirtatious, but we don't really get a full-on romance between those two. So we could, you know, venture through that. You know, Renfield is also exploring his love of pastels and interior design. Who knows what kind of house he'd have if he had the chance to actually do it without this terrible boss breathing down his neck. And also, you know, Dracula, he's never dead, is he? He's never completely dead. Surely he can be reanimated.
There's certainly a lot of scope for it. And what is interesting is how a few years ago, Universal trying to set up a whole dark universe, a kind of shared universe for all their beloved horror properties like Frankenstein's Monster and The Mummy and obviously Count Dracula. And it stalled at the launch pad and it didn't really get past Tom Cruise's attempt to reanimate The Mummy. And I think now, through their own kind of standalones, you had The Invisible Man, you know, years ago, and then this one, they're kind of stumbling upon the possibility of an expanded universe that's a lot more fun than the one they rather sort of grandiosely had in mind. So yeah, I would definitely be happy to see more of it, and I would be love to see more of Nicolas Cage's Dracula and more of Nicholas Holt's Renfield. I mean, the two Nicks.
You mentioned fun there. This is the second film I've seen in the last couple of weeks that is just all out comedy fun. So it reminded me of Dungeons and Dragons, not in content, but in that feel that going to the cinema for a laugh and that being a big blockbuster experience. It doesn't just have to be superheroes. It doesn't just have to be like blue people. You know, that the comedy could be having its moment. Do you think that's the case? Are we sort of ready to laugh in the cinema again and have just a really good rib tickler?
It is a horror comedy that works very well. And it delivers on as much blood as horror fans want, as much laughs as comedy fans want. The only element I didn't think was really helped was the whole crime family element with Ben Schwartz as Awkwafina's sort of crime nemesis and her attempts to bring them down. I didn't think that really added much to the story, apart from, you know, bringing on a lot more henchmen for
arms to be ripped off, you know, exactly. Providing bodies to be ripped apart.
That was their sole function. And I was thinking, kind of the way I feel when I watch the recent John Wick movie, who are these people signing up for these jobs? I mean, literally, is there in a small print, you know, may involve having, throats gouged out and arms ripped off, but, yeah, you know, you'll have to be rewarded. I was wondering, you know, where is this?
What is their pay like? And, you know, what pension plan do they have, these henchmen?
And so that was the element which I didn't think really added to the whole. And if anything, sort of dragged you away from the characters that you really wanted to be spending time with.
Yeah, I did enjoy there was a scene, you know, Dracula is not in a good way when we first meet him in this film. He's a sort of decaying corpse that Renfield has to sort of bring back to life in this old disused hospital by, you know, serving him various pints of blood. I did really enjoy Nicolas Cage with various eyeballs hanging out, skin peeling off and sort of staggering about, doing his voice, trying to come back to full power. I love that. And I'd love to see him do that again. So I just think Cage is also on a run right now, isn't he? What with the unbearable weight of massive talent and this. He's so aware of himself and aware of his brand and fully self-aware of how amusing he can be in that space. And it's just really working for him. I'm loving it.
Yeah, I mean, there was a time when Nicolas Cage movies came along like buses, in terms of almost indistinguishable from another, apart from they were all going to be pretty ropey and generally made one suspects to pay off some form of
tax bill or a castle in somewhere.
But it seems, yes, he seems to have rediscovered his love of acting, his love of being Nicolas Cage and his love of performing, and all of these things very much present in this movie.
Yeah. Nicholas Holt, the other Nick, we must mention, his comic timing is also impeccable, having seen him in The Menu and in this. They're sort of similar characters, but on different sides of the coin. And I just think he's basically a young Hugh Grant, isn't he? His delivery of a zinger in a received pronunciation way with a sort of self-loathing reminds me of Dungeons and Dragons again with the way Hugh Grant does it. So there's plenty of bang for your buck in this, I think. So I think we'd probably say we'd recommend Renfield for a weekend activity.
I think we would, yes. I would positively look forward to Renfield 2.
Okay, so we're asking for that. Renfield is in cinemas now. Right, from undead counts to talking cats, it's this. Okay, so this is Susame, or Susume. Neil, how are we saying this? I've already forgotten, even though I've watched the film.
I think I'm going to go with Susume. I think it just rolls off my English vowels. This is an anime film by the director Makoto Shinkai, who's best known on these shores for Your Name mm-hmm. and Weathering With You. And it's in his familiar vein from those movies. It's a fantasy set in contemporary Japan that draws on Japan's recent history, particularly its traumatic history of natural disasters. It has a young female heroine who embarks on a quest that takes her pretty much all the way across her homeland. And there are elements of a family trauma buried in her past that she has to kind of unlock through what she's doing. As on a story front, it's about a girl called Suzume, I'm going to say Suzume, who is kind of bored in her small town in the bottom of Japan, on an island in the bottom of the Japanese archipelago. And she comes across a handsome young chap who asks her, where is there a door around here? And she says, oh, I think I know where there's a door around here. She finds the door and she probably opens it. She doesn't close it, which I think is asking for trouble. And in a matter of hours, strange worm-like entities are spilling out into her world and bringing with them the threat of earthquakes and tsunamis and other natural disasters. So with the help of the young man who's undertaken quite a peculiar change, she goes on a quest to find the doors and close them before they bring more disasters in their wake.
I like the way that you've summed that up without mentioning that there is a talking three-legged chair and a talking kitten.
Yes. I have a bit of a confession to make in the fact that anime has never completely rocked my boat. Mm-hmm. The master of the genre is Hayao Miyazaki and his studio Ghibli.
Yeah.
And you have like Spirited Away and Howl's Moving Castle. They're rightly loved by people who love this form of animation. For me, I found the storytelling diffuse, hard to get a handle on, and sort of detached from the real world to such an extent that there's nothing really much for me to hold on to. What I like about Makoto Shinkai is that his stories are so rooted in the real world, in a almost photorealistic Japan, the way he kind of sums up the buildings and the cars and the advertising hoardings and the food. It feels almost like a tangible world. So that when it does, particularly with this film, go into storytelling and transformation and weird talking animals and so on, that is more familiar with the Studio Ghibli style of animation, you can there's something that you feel is rooted in the real world. So I feel it's a kind of a perfect meeting between the two styles of animation that kind of make up, if you like, the two poles of Japanese anime.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's not really a thing I enjoy very much. And I find it a bit too sort of fantastical. And I don't have a love of fantasy. And I find that a lot of those films you mentioned do strain into that area. So it's not that I don't like them. It doesn't really emotionally grab me. But I thought that this was one that actually did, because it's just so beautiful to look at. I really felt for Suzume and her sort of coming of age journey, and the fact that, you know, this is like a lot of things, not necessarily about the thing it's really about. It's about a girl coming to terms with grief and loss, and about this national identity and this national anxiety about earthquakes and loss of a nation from various things that have happened in the past. So it's much deeper than you think. But at the same time, I didn't really love the wormy bits, and but I do enjoy Talking Cat, obviously. But I really enjoyed that traveling across Japan and going to Tokyo, and there's karaoke in it, and there's, you know, the eating of beautiful sushi boxes, and that sense of the place I felt was really captured in a beautiful way. And the soundtrack's lovely, and the sound design is lovely. I actually found this was quite a good gateway film for if you hadn't watched any anime, this might be one to start with, because it is, as you say, rooted in both reality and fantasy, and not off-putting too much in either of those camps.
One of the trademarks of Katsu Shinkai's work is how brilliantly he kind of creates this almost photorealistic vision of modern Japan. Mm. That must be so painstaking. It obviously is. I mean, his films take years to come to fruition. But then you realize that what he does is create a world you think, this is a world that we want to see saved, that we don't want to see destroyed. It feels just so sort of tangible and rooted in the real world. Even when you have a little girl running around after a talking cat with her companion who has been transformed into an item of furniture, which is the most bizarre,
which no one really sort of says what the actual is happening here. They're like, oh yeah, that just happened, like what, but okay, we're going with it.
You're willing to go with it simply because he's a master storyteller, and you want to see where this story is going to take you, and where it does take you is actually somewhere, you know, rather sort of more emotional and deeper than you were expecting. So the music, he has a regular collaborators, a band who go by the name of Radwimps. And the music is beautiful. I mean, weeks later from seeing this film, I still have the sort of whispery riff in my head. It's kind of lodged in there. It is enchanting, charming, and moving in a way that a lot of animated films and maybe anime films aren't always.
Yes, indeed. So I think as two people who wouldn't say this was our forte, I think we were saying that this would be one to definitely check out at the weekend and have a go on, even if you have never seen anime before, or if you are, you know, a purveyor of it. I think it will probably satisfy newcomers and experts alike.
And I would definitely suggest if you do enjoy this one, go back and see Your Name, if you haven't already, Weathering With You, because I think that you'll see that in this particular director, there's even in the case of only a few films, he's got a real sort of like, you know, distinctive house style.
Yes.
That carries the whole films, and they aren't necessarily fantastical. In fact, that Your Name is being prepped for a live action film because the story would work just as well in a live action sphere.
Yes, exactly. And he does have this preoccupation with sort of, you know, natural disasters and the sort of the national anxiety of that as well, that features in all of those films you've mentioned. So yes, it's a good companion piece to those, a nice trilogy. That would be a nice weekend, actually, watching all of them. Okay, so if you fancy Suzume, it is in cinemas now. And also, I think it's worth seeing that on a big screen, isn't it? Because it's so lovely to look at.
Yeah, I would recommend that on the big screen, yes.
Yeah, so that one is another two gold stars already. What about the final film for this week then? It's this.
زي ما انتوا عارفين شيخ الازهر توفى امبارح خيار الشيخ الجديد قضيه الامن الوطني بالدرجه الاولى الرئاسه عايزه البلاوي خلوهم يختاروا.
So this is Cairo Conspiracy, which was previously called Boy from Heaven, I think it was, when it was at Cannes. Did you see this at Cannes Film Festival, Neil?
I didn't see it at the Cannes Film Festival. I saw it at the London Film Festival when it was still going by the name Boy from Heaven, which I felt was a slightly more kind of mysterious and intriguing title. I mean, Cairo Conspiracy is a bit generic and doesn't really point to what you get from the film, which, although it is set in Cairo and does involve conspiracy, is a little bit more esoteric than those two words put together might suggest.
It's almost like a genre descriptor rather than a title, isn't it? Cairo Conspiracy. You'll find this in the Cairo Conspiracy section of your video shop. I mean, obviously, I know no one goes to a video shop anymore, but I like the idea. So tell us about this, Neil. Who's in this Cairo Conspiracy? What is the conspiracy at the heart of this?
Well, it's about an Egyptian fisherman's son called Adam, who is awarded a scholarship at Cairo's most prestigious seat of Islamic learning, the Al-Ashtar University in Cairo, as well as being an organization of global renown, is the epicenter of power in Sunni Islam. So it's a very key place to be for a country that obviously where the balance between secular and religious is obviously much closely entwined. He hasn't been there long when its grand imam dies suddenly, and the process of appointing a new one is kind of similar to what goes into appointing a new pope. I mean, it's yeah. of kind of massive significance, to such that the in this story, the government is very keen that its own candidate gets appointed as the new grand imam, one that they can kind of influence and control. So this young man is kind of recruited reluctantly by an intelligent agent called Ibrahim, played by Fares Fares, to become involved and see if he can shape the appointment of the new grand imam from within. So yeah, it's a complex tale of subterfuge and conspiracy in a part of the world that, you know, rarely seen by outsiders' eyes, even if it was actually shot in Turkey for various reasons. And it's intriguing and interesting, but there is a level of cultural understanding that one has to kind of get past that sort of steps in a way of it kind of succeeding as a thriller called Cairo Conspiracy might. It feels like you need to do a bit of homework before you even step into the cinema to fully appreciate its layers of nuance and political complexity.
Yeah, the writer-director is a Swedish director whose father is Egyptian. So he's coming at it not from the country that it's about, but looking at it from an outsider's gaze. And from that point of view, it's very anti-clerical. It's very much a delve into church versus state. The fact that the imam is voted for life, so whoever gets this role is there until they drop dead, and that's hugely important. You know, the military is involved, the state is involved, and they want somebody who is going to bend to their regime so that there's no sort of against it. I mean, there's an interesting point at which somebody explains to this military man that's come in to investigate a murder in this campus that, you know, we've had these people do this and the various changes that have happened trying to mold this organization, and they're very virulently trying to remain their own thing. But will that happen when this boy comes in? And I don't find it thrilling. It was more sort of depressing. It felt very like this could definitely be happening, and that there probably is a sort of machinations going on, not just here, but all over the world. And that at the heart of it, the people that are often involved in this are people that are being forced to because they are in a position that they cannot say no to. And that's certainly the case with Adam, who is this boy who's from a poor family, has never had an opportunity at all to do anything other than fishing. And this opportunity comes along, but it is, of course, it is loaded with caveats. You are not going to be getting a scholarship to this place without you having to pay something back. And how he pays is, in essence, with his soul. So that sort of idea of it, I really enjoyed. And that's why when you said, you know, a boy from heaven chimes much more with what this is really about. This is really about somebody fighting for their soul and losing it and whether they can regain it, rather than the sort of machinations of government and the military complex and all the rest of it. So, yeah, I agree with you. It's very interesting, but I'm not sure it's as gripping as it sort of wants to be as a thriller. I mean, I would never have seen inside the Al-Hajar University. I have no concept of what they do there and the sort of teachings that go on. So I found that sort of idea of peering inside there and seeing their sort of day-to-day life really, really interesting. And obviously as well, like at some point, somebody says rather sagely, after we've gone through some awful guilt tripping and forcing people's hands via corruption, that power is a double-edged sword. And it really is shown here that it can come back to bite you, that nobody really truly wins when power is wielded in that way. So yeah, it's very pertinent, I'm sure, to all kinds of politics at play in the world today.
Well, some comparisons that have been made are to movies like A Prophet, which was a young man going to prison and being tasked with sort of infiltrating a criminal organization, and the Donnie Brasco as well, of the sort of undercover cop going into another rather close-knit community. So there are comparisons to that, and that's the part of the story which is most compelling, this young man being forced to compromise, you know, his ideals, his identity, his sense of security, his family's security, in order to meet the demands of his paymasters, who obviously don't have his best interests at heart any more than they do the people they wish to manipulate within the university we spoke of. That's the part that's kind of compelling. But also, it's also quite a slow movie.
Yeah.
It takes its time. I think it's 2 hours. The elements of conspiracy thriller are quite evenly spaced over the course of the movie, and it doesn't really deliver on that, on the way it's been pitched, certainly to an audience.
Yeah, I agree. So, I mean, if you're looking for a thriller, I don't think this is it. But if you're looking for insight into a world that we don't often see on screen, then it's sort of immersive in that way. But as you say, it's a sort of, it's a meandering film. The pace is not going at a clip. I mean, from one extreme to the other, I mean, we talked about Renfield at the top, and that's just bang, 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 and we're done before 90 minutes. This is a much different pace. That is for some people. I don't know that it was for me. I don't think it would be my film of the week this week.
I did like the performances, though. The young man played by Tawfiq Bahoum has such an expressive face, and he's, you know, he takes you through this sort of young man sort of rite of passage very compellingly. And Farrez is the opposite side. He's sort of a grizzled and cynical intelligence agent handler. So it's a kind of interesting kind of meeting of like the young innocence and the old cynicism, and how they kind of infuse each other and sort of influence each other. And the scenes where it's just the two of them, I think, are the best scenes in the film.
Yeah. I mean, this boy is so innocent. He's never smoked a cigarette, and he turns up and he's astonished that such devout students could even do that. And yeah, he's placed in this situation with this man who he's literally just another one that this man is handling, and he handles him in exactly the same way as he handled the previous boy he sort of had in there. So yeah, that sort of dichotomy between the very sort of innocent and the very jaded is quite interesting. But yeah, this is for people who enjoy this director's work and want to see more of this part of the world. I think probably my film of the week would be Renfield.
I think I'm going to go with Suzume, actually. That's the one that's probably going to stay with me longer.
Okay, so Cairo Conspiracy is out in cinemas on Friday if you want to go and see it. That was short and sweet, Neil, a bit like Renfield, but your film of the week is Suzume, mine is Renfield, and a reminder that if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing, and then it just appears for you. You just listen to it, you don't have to look for it. Also to remind you that we have a new issue out on the 27th. Do look for that. Interesting and exciting cover coming. And we'll have everyone back next week to review more films. But before we go, we've got time for a listener's question. Are you ready for this? What's the best fruit usage in movies? Neil, fruit usage in movies.
That's a great question. And the thing that immediately pops to mind is the drive-by fruiting from Mrs. Doubtfire, in which Robin Williams in his guise as Mrs. Doubtfire throws a lime at Pierce Brosnan's head. And that comes to mind purely for the fact that I'm going to be going to see the new West End musical version of Mrs. Doubtfire. So that's what pops to mind when I'm thinking of fruit usage in cinema.
Yes. Oh, dear, a drive-by fruiting, which I think you said was an ad-lib by Mr. Williams. Of course it was. Excellent. I'm going to go for, I mean, I don't think you can think about Call Me By Your Name without thinking of peach defilement. That peach has a lovely time with Timothy Chalamet. I think that's a good one. And obviously, we have to discuss the oranges in The Godfather that foreshadow death. Oranges rolling out of brown paper bags that denotes the Grim Reaper has been round via the Mafia. So those would be my two. Also enjoy The Wizard of Oz horrible trees that throw their own fruit at Dorothy and gang when they get peeved.
And I suppose there's the banana in the tailpipe from Beverly Hills Cop.
A classic. What a great way to finish. And I think I know what our outro theme will be based on that. So for now, let's say goodbye, Neil. Say goodbye.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. Goodbye.